A horizontal bar of static expands to fill the view, then resolves into letters. HBO. White dots coalesce on a black background to form the text. HBO Documentary Films. Text appears. HBO Documentary Films presents. Wind turbines stand in silhouette under a cloudy sky. A blowback production. A car drives down a long straight road through flatland. Executive producer, Katie Couric. A film by Mark Levin and Daphne Pinkerson.
It's frighteningly clear now that there is no way to win the struggle in which we are engaged without shedding torrents, veritable rivers of blood.
At night, lightning flashes within the clouds.
It's just an endless parade of the dregs of our society. This is your country. These are the people that live next door to you. This is what's become of your country.
Neutering the Second Amendment with the assault weapons ban, violating the Tenth Amendment with the Brady Bill, and slaughtering citizens using the ATF and the FBI Schutzstaffel is shredding the Constitution.
The enemy has many, many resources and assets at their disposal. The best one we have here is you.
The title appears over lightning flashes. An American Bombing. The Road to April 19th. On a farm, small yellow flowers fill a vast field. Text appears over a memorial depicting a mounted figure beside a bull, Oklahoma City. Text appears over home footage of a white woman with bushy brown hair. 1995.
Yeah, now you're on it. Whoa.
I don't think so.
Yeah, the red lights, huh?
Does it say recorded there?
Every April 19th is bittersweet.
Kathy Sanders.
I remember exactly what I was doing that morning.
Who's in that cave?
Two toddlers peek out from a blanket fort.
What's on my back?
A raccoon.
My grandchildren, Chase and Colton. I went in and flipped the light on in their bedroom, and I sang, good morning to you, good morning to you. We're all in our places with sunshiny faces. What a nice way to start a new Wednesday. And Chase begins to giggle.
Those are so cute. What are you eating, Chase?
Bye-bye.
I remember when I left him at the daycare.
It's Jenny first.
I love you. Are we on our way to school?
They're in the federal building. The little donut crumbs that were on their faces.
Children gather in a daycare center.
Then, at 9:02.
In aerial footage, black smoke rises by a partially destroyed government building.
It looks like part of the building has been blown away. We'll have to back around the other side so I can get a better view of it.
As the chopper goes around the side of the federal building,
wow.
Look at that shot.
Holy cow.
Absolutely incredible. The federal building has been blown off.
Cars burn in a parking lot beside the building. Debris litters the pavement. People run down a street. A person with a blood-soaked face clutches another person's hand. People climb over a wall and flee. Workers carry stretchers. Smoke wafts into the pale blue sky. The view frames a honeycomb of blown-out rooms.
It felt to me like my skin was burning off.
Nancy Shaw.
It was very hot, and it was a wind so powerful that it felt like it pinned my hair back.
Marcia Kimball.
I heard a very loud explosion, and I noticed a plume of smoke coming up from downtown Oklahoma City. So I ran back in the house and turned on the TV. That's where my daughter Frankie works. And as we made our way closer to the building, I said, my daughter is dead.
Flames burn within cars. Photos of two young women.
I had little hope.
Bud Welch.
Because Julie worked on the first floor. And of course, the first floor had more deaths than any other floor.
LaDonna Battle Leverett.
April 19th, my dad had an appointment to go down to the Social Security building that morning. I knew my mom went down with him.
A photo of her parents.
The news starts to come in. There's been a bomb. When they said the Social Security building, I mean, everything at that moment just stopped.
People tend to others lying on the ground among debris.
In the heart of Oklahoma, in the heart of the capital city, a terrible bomb has been exploded. The governor has had a report that 6 children were killed in a daycare center.
A man carries a wounded child. Someone pushes another injured child in a wheelchair. People carry more wounded children.
I said to my daughter, I said, Edie, the babies. And we take off running to the north side of the building, and the building's gone.
Footage of the building shows a large part missing from one side. A young Kathy and a younger brown-haired woman embrace.
My son was an off-duty police officer. He saw his mom and his sister on TV. He knew something was wrong.
Daniel Koss, former Oklahoma police officer.
I looked up at the TV and I saw my mom and my sister clutching each other. And my sister was screaming, "Where's my babies? Where's my babies? Where's my babies?"
Kathy hugs her daughter tightly and pats her head. Emergency personnel wheel a gurney.
Okay, now we got information on where they have taken the children from the daycare.
I have not been advised.
Upon arrival at the site, my partner and I went into the rubble. I went to the back side of the building, which would be on the side of the daycare center. They had about 10 to 12 children laid out on a piece of concrete slab, and they were just laid one next to the other, and at the very end to the right, I found Colton.
Children's toys and shoes lie among the debris.
You know, I knew that'd be the last time I saw my nephew. Then I asked a state law enforcement officer that was there if I could reach down and hug him and kiss him goodbye. And he told me, "This is a crime scene. Do not touch the evidence."
Daniel's eyes shine. Smoke wafts over cars in the lot beside the ruined building. Text appears. The bomb killed 168 people, including 19 children. The view focuses on the jagged, cavernous openings of blown-out offices. Lettering on the side of the building reads, "Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building." Footage of an interview with Kathy and her daughter plays.
Of all the sad stories in Oklahoma City today, the most heartbreaking may be the stories of the children who were in the daycare center when the bomb exploded. What is your overwhelming emotion as you face this horrendous tragedy in your family?
Those babies were just like mine, and I loved them. And anybody could understand the loss of a child, but to then have to watch your child grieve over the loss of those children, it's devastating.
Edie, are you confident that the people behind this will be caught?
I don't know. I hope so. I don't know.
A sign reads, "God bless Oklahoma City." Michael Betcher, investigative reporter.
As a young reporter, I used to cover Oklahoma City streets. Usually nothing more exciting than a car crash.
You know, everyone at NBC News knew I was an Okie because I always bragged about the fact that I was an Okie. So there was no doubt who they were going to send. When I got to the side of the federal building, I thought, this can't be the place where I lived, Oklahoma City.
A firefighter shifts rubble.
It reminded me of Beirut.
Text appears over footage of another bombing. U.S. Embassy bombing, Beirut, 1983.
Brought back memories of the Marine barracks and the embassy bombing and other terrorist attacks that I covered. Then I said, this is Oklahoma. This can't happen here.
A photo of a firefighter before the smoking building.
A U.S. government source has told CBS News that it has Middle East terrorism written all over it.
You know, everyone was thinking Arab terrorism because there had been an attempt to bomb the World Trade Center.
World Trade Center bombing, 1993.
And the bombers, they were from the Middle East. But I went to NBC and said, let me put together a team to investigate this. The first person I thought of is Bob Sands.
Bob Sands.
I have this friend, and he had done some work for some far right-wing people in Duncan, Oklahoma. So I said, just check the boards and see what the chatter is.
Nazi symbols mark a webpage.
About an hour later, he called me and said, you're not going to believe this. You need to come here. People were just going ape over it in the far right, the militia movement, saying, who did this? What's that all about? That's awesome.
Footage of President Bill Clinton.
I would just ask that you and the American people not rush to any conclusions unsupported by known evidence, and that we give the investigators the space they need to do their job.
My initial reaction was, first of all, to try to get everybody to calm down and not react with their words. I didn't want to stir whatever was going on up anymore. And everyone immediately assumed that it was a Muslim extremist attack.
Bill Clinton.
And I wasn't so sure.
Shoot from the way.
My native state was almost like honey for bees to attract a lot of these extremist groups, and they moved in and out of there. When Oklahoma City happened, my life and experience told me that there was a very good chance that this was a homegrown plot.
Danny Colson, former FBI special agent.
On the drive up there, there's a lot of things going on in your head. You got to command a major bombing investigation, and you're thinking of all the things you have to do. And I'm thinking April 19th, okay. I just filed it away. I get a call from a nationally known reporter, and she said, is this Middle Eastern? I said, no, it's Bubba's. April 19th, 2 years earlier. April 19th was the siege in Waco. And I thought we were seeing the result of that anger against actions on the part of the government. My thought is it's going to be Bubba's.
Heavy damage, emergency crews trying to assist the injured. We have no
that day, it was overwhelming to first go to the crime scene.
Bob Ricks.
Secret Service, IRS, ATF, multiple federal agencies were housed in that building. I was walking approximately a block and a half from the bomb scene. There were two FBI agents and a sheriff looking at this rear axle of a truck. It believed it had come from the truck responsible for the bombing. And they were removing the VIN number from the rear axle. And I told him to guard that with your life. That's probably going to be the most important piece of evidence we have in this entire investigation.
A heat haze ripples on a highway as cars drive. A sign reads, Interstate 35.
We learned that particular truck had been rented 3 or 4 days before in Junction City, Kansas. The person who rented it went by the name of Robert Kling, and he used a birth date of April 19th. The mechanic that was working there probably had the best recollection of what he looked like. Also, he had a recollection of a person he thought had been with him, commonly called John Doe number 2.
How you doing today, sir? We're trying to conduct an investigation on Oklahoma City bombing.
You notice a lighter truck or a yellow truck?
We sent agents all over the country, primarily on I-35, going north and south in the United States. They went to a place called the Dreamland Hotel. They interviewed the owner, showed the pictures. Oh, yeah, he was here. His name's Tim McVeigh.
Well, it's a very nice young man, basically.
Leah McGowan, owner.
And that's very shocking to think somebody has such a deprived mind.
We got the registration information. His name was Timothy McVeigh. So an agent runs the name of Timothy McVeigh, and he gets a hit and says, boss, you're not going to believe this bullshit, but Timothy McVeigh is in custody.
A mugshot of a dark-haired white man.
He had been arrested an hour and a half after the bombing in Perry, Oklahoma.
Dan Herbeck, co-author, American Terrorist.
Here he is in his Junker getaway car driving away from the scene of the crime. And he gets on the thruway and he thinks he's gotten away with it. It turns out that McVeigh was missing a license plate from his vehicle. And the trooper starts questioning McVeigh. He ascertains that McVeigh is carrying an unregistered handgun. He arrests McVeigh. McVeigh was wearing a T-shirt celebrating the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And it always has astonished me that nobody put these two things together at the time. But for two full days, they had no idea that he was involved with the bombing. And they were getting close to letting him go.
it's just hard to believe. You think, you know, it's going to be a nationwide search, and now you're told that he's roughly 70 miles away.
I said, call him and tell him, don't let that boy out. And you can imagine my phone ringing off my belt. I mean, the attorney general's calling, the director of the FBI is calling me, get him out of there. Well, I was concerned about a rescue or attempt to kill him. And I didn't want to be the man who took McVeigh into custody and got him killed. Not good. I'd be working at Dairy Queen if that happened.
Footage of Timothy McVeigh being escorted from a building in handcuffs.
He was captured about 30 miles from where I grew up. And I thought it was foreigners. Because I didn't want to believe an American could do this.
He wears a stern expression on his long, thin face.
And they marched Timothy McVeigh out of that jail. And I go, you know, it wasn't a foreigner. This is an American doing this to Americans.
Officers and FBI agents stay close around him.
I was a little surprised that it was an American. I drew a conclusion pretty quick that this was payback for Waco and the kids that were killed there. You killed our kids, we're going to kill your kids.
When I saw him on television, I felt like I'd seen him in the building before. I remember being in the elevator, and two men got on the elevator, and one of them was McVeigh. I always wondered if that was real or if I imagined that with everything else going on.
He had that orange jumpsuit on. And my thought was, I hope that somebody has a rifle and can just pick him off there. I mean, I was really wishing for that.
A photo of McVeigh with law enforcement.
You're looking for the monster and you finally get that day to see him. And you're thinking like, wait a minute, is this him? He looked like anyone's kid. Just your normal, average Joe.
Kerry Noble, former extremist.
He's got this look in his eyes. I believe that in his mind, he wanted to look out of the crowd and right straight into the camera and go, you're goddamn right I did it. And you're cowards if you don't do the same thing.
The agents put McVeigh into a helicopter. It takes off.
There goes Tim McVeigh, the first confirmed arrest in the Oklahoma bombing case.
A photo of a middle-aged white man with dark hair, Bill McVeigh, father of Timothy McVeigh.
After I had McVeigh in custody, I had McVeigh's father flown to Oklahoma City to meet with me. I asked him, you know your son, who would be involved in this? And he said, Terry Nichols and Michael Fortier. Like that.
We learned that he had been in basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, with a couple of guys named Terry Nichols and Michael Fortier. Terry Nichols was older, but they had struck up a friendship based on their political beliefs. We then learned that Terry Nichols is now living in Kansas. At his residence, we find the remnants of fertilizer that was used in the bombing itself. But one of the biggest and most important pieces of information is a telephone card sold by a right-wing group called Spotlight. We pretty much were able to trace where they had been throughout the United States through that calling card.
Kingman, Arizona.
We find that Michael Fortier is now living in Arizona.
Michael Fortier.
I think people are looking right now for somebody to hang. Now he may feel like there's nobody on this earth that is in any way supportive of him, but there is. There is. Everybody should be supportive of him because he's an innocent man.
I interviewed Michael Fortier. I said to him, I need your help. And he said, you don't understand, we're at war. I said, I'd have killed you today. I'd have killed you now. We're at war. I'd have killed your buddies. We're not. You may be at war with your country. Your country's not at war with you.
I do not believe that Tim blew up any building in Oklahoma.
And then he said to me, it's about the Constitution. I said, you're right. It is about the Constitution. Let me tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to indict you under the Constitution. I'm going to convict you under the Constitution. We'll handle your appeals under the Constitution. And sooner or later, somebody's going to put you on a gurney and stick a needle in your arm, we're going to kill you. Now, you better decide you're on my side or their side.
A prisoner transport bus drives.
Later on, after McVeigh had been charged, his attorneys let reporters meet with McVeigh one-on-one. The ground rule is, this is not an interview. This is kind of a get-to-know-you. I had covered the first Gulf War, and I knew he had been a veteran of that war. And we started talking about the Gulf War, and he kind of lit up because it was something that he could talk about, that he felt proud of, that he had participated in. And then I shifted the conversation to his feelings about the U.S. government. And I could see a light switch go off in his eyes. And he went cold. And you could see the anger well up. And I thought at that point, this guy for sure did it.
When Tim was identified, I just started delving into the far right. I went to Little Rock, Arkansas, and did a whole lot of research there because back in those days, you had to go actually look at hard paper. Turns out, way back in 1983, this virulent racist by the name of Richard Wayne Snell had decided that he wanted to blow up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. I was stunned to find out that the far-right movement wanted to blow up the Murrah Building. Well, how come we never heard about that before?
Text appears. First wave, 1983. Heavily armed men in matching uniforms run across a snowy landscape. Small explosions burst around them.
Halo! Get up! Woo!
Pro-gun patriotism is becoming more and more popular among economically hard-pressed farmers.
Traditionally strong, proud, independent farmers are losing their farms in record numbers.
Stuart Wright.
We think as many as a million family farms were foreclosed on during the late 70s, early 80s. There was anger against the federal government's exploitation of farmers.
Stephen Jones, attorney.
Violence starts to occur in the heartland because they were desperate.
A photo of Nixon on a tractor.
When Mr. Nixon was president, he encouraged farmers plant fence row to fence row, and they did. But then, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, President Carter put an embargo on grain sales to the Soviet Union. And the result was agricultural depression.
The federal government mustn't shirk its responsibility to help undo some of the damage that it created. We're doing a great deal to help farmers. But the federal government will not bail out every farmer hopelessly in debt. So today, I have vetoed this massive new bailout.
Ronald Reagan basically left the farmers to just go bankrupt. Far-right leaders saw a political opportunity. The first wave of the Patriot Movement was able to successfully mobilize farmers into this far-right movement, and they were willing to take up arms, and some of them did.
Everybody in the movement saw the land crisis, farm crisis, as the government and major corporations putting farmers into a financial bind, where the government is making war with the American people and selling us out.
I don't want to see our group or any group forced against their will into a confrontation.
I'm a former extremist from a group known as CSA, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Armor of the Lord in northern Arkansas back in the 70s and 80s. For me, it was like heaven on earth.
People in a small crowd sing.
The group was started originally by Jim Ellison to establish a community based upon the apocalypse.
James Jim Ellison, CSA leader.
God began to deal with us about the economic judgment, collapse, and upheaval that was coming upon all the world, and especially on this country.
And he said, but how are you going to protect yourself when it collapses and bad people want what you have?
Basically, the Bible says that we have the right to use whatever the enemy uses. And the enemy, of course, is going to have guns.
Fire!
Men and women in uniform fire weapons.
We had never talked about guns before. We had never talked about defense.
CSA training exercise, armed people run through a snowy forest.
Over the next 18 months, we started buying guns, buying military equipment, and we trained so well that a magazine in those days called us the number one civilian SWAT team in the United States.
They exchange fire with a shooter in an upper window.
The church kind of went to the background. Guns and the warfare went to the forefront. The first plan that we talked about was the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Sort of a quasi-member of the group, Richard Wayne Snell, he lived in Oklahoma, was having trouble with the IRS. Him and Jim went and cased the Murrah Building. There was a lot of federal offices in that building, so it seemed like a good target of various agencies being in that building. So we had our munitions guys start to develop a rocket launcher, and all the rockets would be shot at the same time toward the Murrah Building. One of the missiles exploded in the guy's hands that was building them, scarred his hands real bad. So we took that as a sign that from God that we weren't supposed to do that particular plan.
Asa Hutchinson, former U.S. attorney, Arkansas.
I was surprised as to the extent of violence of this group, believing that they were going to cause the collapse of the United States of America and that they were going to help create that collapse. We actually learned that Richard Wayne Snell, a member of the CSA, shot and killed a pawn shop owner in Texarkana, believing he was Jewish, had killed Lewis Bryant, a state police trooper, murdered, I believe that was in 84.
Got out of my van, and I shot Officer Bryant twice from the hip.
A photo of a black officer.
The death of Trooper Lewis Bryant was especially heartbreaking for Bill Clinton. While the governor was visibly shaken over the slaying, he was also angry.
You know, they don't have a right to go around carrying weapons and taking the law in their hands and acting as if they're somehow playing God.
Snell got the death penalty. Snell's execution was to be on the night of April 19th, 1995, which happened to be the day the Oklahoma City Federal Building got bombed. In the movement, April 19th, of course, is what's called Patriot's Day. First shot fired during the American Revolution. Very special for the whole movement. Jim told me one time, he said, I will go down in history in the second American Revolution. In 84, I told Jim, I said, so you really want all this to start? He said, yes. I said, so build a bomb and we'll start the war. So we decided to go to find a good place to do the bombing.
A headline reads, Church offers haven for gay Christians.
We found the gay church. We sort of had this stereotype image in our heads that there was just going to be this sexual orgy going on, which of course there wasn't. I start seeing people lift their hands up and lift their eyes up, look up and start worshiping God. And I identified with them. So instantly, they ceased being homosexuals in my eyes and became Christians. And I couldn't kill Christians.
CSA Compound, Arkansas.
Later, I'm trying to talk to God. And I said, Lord, I want to leave. You know, I can't handle this no more. And the Lord spoke to me and said, you can't leave.
Siege of the CSA, April 19th, 1985.
It looks like a battle zone. Police and federal agents blockading the roads, surrounding the heavily armed compound of a white supremacist sect calling itself the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. They want to arrest the leader, James Ellison, on an illegal weapons charge.
Covenant, Sword, the Arm of the Lord. They lived in log cabins. Every log cabin had a trap door. When you dropped through the trap door, you were in a foxhole with your weapon and ammunition ready. Federal officials, they really wanted to storm this compound, just like what later happened in Waco.
We knew that a frontal assault attack on that entity, a lot of people had died, and we didn't want that. I did not want that. My job is not to kill people. I know how to do it, but I don't want to do it. And I didn't want to get in a shootout in the Ozarks. They had murder on their mind, and they were all doing it for God. I found somebody I could talk to. Actually, he came to me, Kerry Noble.
He said, I want to make this plan. We are not going to shoot first. We don't want to kill anybody here. But if y'all shoot first, I've got a Huey helicopter. It's going to come up. It's got a 50 caliber machine gun. It's going to start shooting holes in all your buildings. And in 30 seconds, every man, woman, and child in your compound is going to be dead. So for 4 days, I went back and forth talking to Jim, talking to Danny. Finally, on the fourth day, Jim got that revelation that he could justify in his mind a higher purpose in surrendering. We get down there, and then Danny looks at Jim and says, I'm placing you under arrest, but I'm not going to handcuff you right now because I would not want to be handcuffed in front of my men. I'm just bawling.
Broadcast footage shows officers detaining a man as well as collections of guns.
The four-day siege ended as quietly as it began. The FBI got more than it bargained for. Other weapons found at the camp read like an arsenal checklist. Hand grenade casings, blasting caps, dynamite, and various handguns.
We found cyanide in huge barrels. They were going to poison water supplies.
In addition to the arrest of CSA leader James Ellison by federal and state authorities...
Jim ended up taking a plea bargain on the weapons charges. I got arrested, ended up plea bargaining, five-year sentence. My dream for moving there had turned into a nightmare. But the movement continued to grow.
A sign reads, Church of Jesus Christ Christian Aryan Nations.
The White Power movement had come together every summer at the Aryan Nations World Congress in Hayden Lake, Idaho.
Kathleen Ballou.
In 1983, the movement adopted a number of key strategies, and it decided to declare war on the federal government.
Richard Butler.
There is nothing more that the white Aryan can do but obey the commandment of Yahweh his God and separate himself.
Louis Beam, KKK leader.
Blood, blood.
They thought mainstream politics could never, ever deliver the kinds of social changes they wanted.
A headline reads, White terrorists have declared war on USA.
In the 80s, there is a major campaign of violence and crime carried out by this movement across the United States.
Footage of a cross burning.
Robbing armored cars, bombings of gay theaters, assassinations.
Last night, Alan Berg was killed in ambush, arriving at his Denver home. 10.45 caliber shell casings
were near his body. It's a spree. By 1987, the government believes it has a case that all of this activity represents an organized criminal conspiracy to overthrow the United States government.
Fort Smith, Arkansas, 1988.
Charges of sedition were filed against Reverend Butler and others. In its opening statement, the government said it intends to prove that 10 of the defendants plotted to overthrow the government by force.
Seditious conspiracy is a hard charge to prove. Prosecutors have to show that they intended to overthrow the U.S. government and had the capacity to do so.
What the FBI now sees across the country is a national network of neo-Nazis and white supremacist groups whose goal is to purge this country of blacks, Jews, and other minorities.
One, I want to praise Yahweh's holy and precious name. Two, I want to say to hell with the federal government.
Louis Beam is really the intellectual architect of leaderless resistance. And I think this has been the biggest legacy of the White Power movement and the reason it's been with us since 1983. Activists can work violently in common cause without direct communication with leaders. There are still leaders in leaderless resistance, but they're not culpable because you can't trace them to the individual violent actions.
I understood that was their intent, but I also knew that an Arkansas jury would have a hard time convicting these folks of attempted overthrow of the United States government when they had no capacity really to do that.
That's why it's called a conspiracy.
Steven Snyder.
The thought was trying to overthrow the government. Actually, they couldn't do it, but they certainly tried.
The government had really bet the farm on this trial. They had used all of these other busts to kind of amass state's witnesses. And it fails spectacularly.
It was the first serious setback in the federal government's war against suspected white supremacist groups. 13 defendants were found not guilty of all charges, which included murder, robbery, and conspiracy to overthrow the government.
It was a tremendous defeat for the government, and it totally enabled the far-right movement. We're free to go do whatever we want to do. They tried, they missed. We have got them by the short hairs.
Sheila Beam passed out and had to be carried off by her husband, who now walks free.
Leaderless resistance was Louis Beam's idea, and he passed it along to everybody else in the movement. The best way to go after the government was not to have this organized CSA compound, but to have individuals, which led, of course, to the term lone wolves.
A headshot of McVeigh rests among other blacked-out headshots. Text appears, second wave, 1990. Under a bright sun, people hold guns aloft. First Gulf War, 1990 to 91.
Iraqi troops have crossed the border into Kuwait.
George H.W. Bush.
As was the case in the 1930s, we see in Saddam Hussein an aggressive dictator threatening his neighbors.
In our history of extremist movements in the United States, the most consistent correlation with spikes in membership is the aftermath of combat.
A line of tanks fire their cannons. A tank drives over an embankment. Louis Beam faces a group of soldiers.
Louis Beam understood this veteran connection very, very well. He did this very specifically, going to military bases, recruiting active duty troops, recruiting veterans. These groups move from, you know, the white robe and hood to camouflage fatigues, able to take in a new generation of veterans coming home. Most notably, Timothy McVeigh.
Text appears. Buffalo, New York. Erie Canal. Lou Michael, co-author, American Terrorist.
Tim McVeigh came from a family that was literally the salt of the earth. They had come over in the 19th century to help with the canal and earned enough money to buy some farmland. You had the dawn of the automobile and Harrison Radiator, the sprawling plant where as many as 8,000 people worked at one time, and that was the world that Bill McVeigh was offering to his son.
Bill McVeigh, father of Timothy McVeigh.
All four houses we lived in, we always had a pretty good sized garden. We had a pool here. Sometimes in the summer, I'd come home from work and there'd be 15 kids in the pool. Family right next door in McDermott's, they had a daughter the same age as Jennifer, Molly. They were good everyday neighbors.
Molly McDermott.
He would play with us, he would babysit us, he took us trick-or-treating, and so I've known his family forever. I'm sure that the divorce with his parents was hard. When the split occurred, he chose to stay with his dad.
A photo of McVeigh and Bill.
There was nobody that McVeigh loved or admired more than his grandfather, Ed McVeigh. He taught Tim McVeigh all about proper handling of guns, how to use guns. I think he equated guns with his beloved grandfather.
Jeffrey Toobin, author, Homegrown.
Tim McVeigh's father worked at a GM plant for 30 years. Tim McVeigh's grandfather worked in the same plant for 30 years. By the time McVeigh came along, that plant was shrinking almost to non-existence. The industrial decline of the Buffalo area was a formative influence on McVeigh. At the same time, Terry Nichols was growing up on a small, struggling farm in the Thumb of Michigan. And the farm crisis was making it harder and harder for farmers like him to survive. So McVeigh and Nichols represent the crisis in American agriculture and the crisis in American industry to an almost perfect degree.
McVeigh smiles in street clothes and fatigues.
I don't know when the idea to go into the military really came, but the first time I even sensed Tim seeming different was after his time over during the Gulf War.
Footage from the Gulf War.
The bombing in Iraq began 24 hours ago. It is still going on.
Plumes of smoke rise from a vast plain.
Watch your lane.
Soldiers perform a prone shooting drill.
At Fort Benning, Terry Nichols became one of McVeigh's best friends. He was very influential on McVeigh's views of politics. McVeigh became close to Michael Fortier, who would smoke dope when he was out on patrol. One of the very first experiences McVeigh had after joining the Army was these drill sergeants They would scream things like, kill, kill, kill.
McVeigh and his friends posed by a tank.
McVeigh became a very skilled sharpshooter in the Bradley military vehicle.
In one instance, he spotted two Iraqi soldiers, brought them into his sights. He said all he saw was a red mist. He was proud of his kill. He got a Bronze Star for it. But as this very short war progressed, he saw the carnage from all of the bombs that had been dropped. It was overkill to him.
Children's toys rest among scattered items. Michael Betcher, Kuwait.
This unit of men is trying to talk the Iraqis into surrendering. There are a group of men, Iraqis to the right, carrying white flags. Over there, a large number of Iraqi tanks.
I've been in a lot of wars. And wars and combat affect different people different ways. I think what goes on in a lot of people who leave war is that they had a purpose. And the purpose in Desert Storm was to take back Kuwait and defeat Saddam Hussein's army. And that was a huge purpose, a huge global purpose. Then you come back home and you might have trouble finding a job, and you start getting discouraged.
Tim McVeigh and myself, we both have that title, veteran. We spend 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years of our life serving our nation. Then when you get out of the military, you come back to the United States, and everyone's telling you that you're wrong, and you shouldn't be killing people, we shouldn't be at war.
At a protest, a sign reads, "No blood for oil, Bud Welch."
My daughter, Julie, demonstrated with a lot of other students against the Gulf War. And the results of that war is actually the very thing that ended up causing her death.
How do you mean that?
Well, because Tim McVeigh served in the Gulf War, had PTSD. Those soldiers saw Iraqis get shot in the back and saw tanks that actually buried some Iraqi soldiers alive. They saw all that angry stuff and came back angry young men.
Dan Herbeck.
After the war, McVeigh went to this Green Beret tryout. He failed in his tryout to become a Green Beret. That was a demoralizing thing. I think if he had succeeded and been selected as a Green Beret, he probably would have been a great killing machine for the U.S. government.
He comes home, and he has a nervous breakdown. He went over to his grandfather's house in February, a few months after he'd been out of the military, in a pair of sweatpants and just socks, no shirt. And Ed McVeigh opens the front door and says, Timmy, what's going on here? He says, I don't know, Grandpa.
Snow falls outside a red one-story house.
McVeigh having PTSD, I think, helps to explain maybe the vulnerability, the fragility of his thinking. He would live in his car. He would sleep in his car. He would listen to right-wing radio. I'd go from gun show to gun show.
People mill about a gun show.
He was operating as sort of a straw buyer. He was buying guns for people who didn't want any kind of record or even name associated with buying guns. And he knew that these people were part of the insurgency. They're not just selling weapons, they're selling ideology.
I'm William Pierce, and I'll be reading my book, The Turner Diaries, to you. Listen carefully. How it shamed us. All that brave talk by patriots. The government will never take my guns away. And then nothing but meek submission when it happened.
Michael Lewicki.
Timothy McVeigh used this book as a Bible. Both the Turner Diaries and McVeigh targeted a federal building that had federal law enforcement agents in it. Both used a truck bomb. Both used a mixture of fuel oil and ammonium nitrate fertilizer. The one that strikes me the most eerie is the fact that the bomb that explodes and blows up the FBI building in the Turner Diaries went off at 9:15 a.m. the bomb in Oklahoma City went off at 9:02.
An illustration depicts smoke rising from a pile of rubble.
He's got the Turner Diaries rolling in the back of his head, his love of guns, and he's buying these videos about things like Ruby Ridge.
Ruby Ridge, Idaho, 1992. A cabin stands atop a tree-covered mountain.
Randy Weaver, a fugitive on a federal firearms charge, has been holed up in a cabin near Naples for more than a year.
Ruby Ridge came about because of shady dealings by the federal government. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agents were trying to recruit Randy Weaver to be an informant on the militia movement by having another informant sell him a shotgun that was a quarter of an inch shy of the legal limit. That looks a lot like entrapment.
With the sudden appearance of military hardware, his one-man stand against the law is suddenly taking on the appearance of a full-blown war.
The federal agent has been shot and killed.
Randy Weaver's 13-year-old son died during the initial shootout Friday.
His blood is on all your hands!
Federal marshals shot my son Samuel in the back and killed him. He was running home to me. His last words were, "I'm coming, Dad."
The FBI adopted military rules of engagement at Ruby Ridge. The day after Sammy Weaver was shot, a sniper fired at Randy. The bullet went into the cabin and hit his wife, Vicki Weaver, in the head and killed her.
People sit in a circle holding hands.
Later, an investigation was done and the Department of Justice settled for $3.1 million for unlawful death of Sammy Weaver and Vicki Weaver.
We have just gotten an update now from federal authorities.
Randy's in good health. Unfortunately, Vicki is dead.
Three women hold each other close. Another woman weeps.
This time the federals game for Randy Weaver.
Next time they may come for you.
After Ruby Ridge, McVeigh was on an odyssey to nowhere for about 2 years.
A gray sedan drives down a long straight road through flatland.
And these ideas would just be turned over in his head again and again.
His car was an old Chevy. He nicknamed it the Road Warrior. He reconnects with his Army buddies, Michael Fortier and Terry Nichols, but there's a lot of alone time. He's manufacturing his arguments of why he hates the government.
National Guard Armory, Charleston, West Virginia.
It may not be popular in West Virginia or Arkansas, where half the people have a hunting or a fishing license or both, but I think we ought to pass the Brady Bill and require a waiting period before people can get a handgun.
I felt that if it was ever going to be done, I was in the best position because I grew up in Arkansas. I had a 22 when I was 10. I had a 410 shotgun when I was 14. You know, I grew up in the culture.
People in camo shoot various guns.
There's really only one thing you need to know. The Democrats want to do away with the Second Amendment. They want to end up registering every gun and its owner in this country. And their ultimate objective is to see to it that nobody has any.
The gray sedan drives down a road at night. A low building stands in a wide field under a blue sky. Waco, Texas, 1993. McVeigh sits on a car in a flannel shirt.
Some people forget that Tim McVeigh was at Waco. He was handing out anti-government pamphlets. He was carrying copies of the Turner Diaries. He was talking to people during the standoff.
A dark-haired, bespectacled man speaks to a group.
If you're a true Christian and you believe the truth and you know the truth will set you free. We're being
a group called the Branch Davidians. It was an offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. About 100 people headed up by a gentleman by the name of David Koresh. He predicted the end of the world was near, that he was the second coming of Jesus Christ. The apocalypse was going to happen. And it was going to start there with a battle on the plains of Texas.
You have guns?
It makes nobody's business whether we have a gun or not at this place.
The ATF had information that there were automatic weapons. They had grenades there. And as a result, they were going to launch an attack on the Branch Davidian compound.
Get my battery, John. Get my battery behind the bus. Yeah.
The ATF wanted to conduct a paramilitary raid. They had multiple opportunities to arrest David Koresh. He jogged up and down Double E Ranch Road right in front of the surveillance houses. They could have grabbed him then. They didn't want to arrest him. They wanted a big show, and it backfired on them.
An ATF agent breaks open a window. Others take cover behind vehicles.
The ATF fired the first shot, shooting the dogs that were outside guarding the property. And then it erupted into gunfire.
Bullets ripped through a wall.
ATF was immediately pinned down. Four of their agents were killed. 16 were wounded. 5 Davidians are killed that day. The attorney general says that FBI should take over and try to get this thing resolved. I was dispatched down there to do the press conferences.
So we're dealing with people who are very committed to what they're doing.
And we end up spending 51 days there.
A helicopter flies overhead.
I actually came here about 3 weeks into the standoff. They wouldn't let anybody closer than, say, maybe a mile from here. They had cordoned it off. A lot of the people who showed up were far-right patriots. They were aligned with, say, Davidian religious beliefs or sentiments.
You have attempted to cover up the FBI and ATF crimes here.
It was already taking place, that co-optation of Waco for the far-right patriot movement.
Waco is not a white power community. It is a multiracial community. The white power movement doesn't care about that very much. And the compound itself, because this goes on for so long, becomes a site where white power activists can organize and talk to each other. And McVeigh travels to the Waco site.
Just arrived today.
Timothy McVeigh, Waco, 1993.
I guess somebody told me a lot of people would be scared to put something on, you know, like this.
A sticker reads, "Fear the government that fears your gun."
Tim said to me, "The government is at war with us." And he kept talking about this war. And I wasn't even privy to this narrative or story. So I asked him to explain it to me. And he tells me that in the early 80s, the Reagan administration pushes for a military role in drug enforcement.
"We waged a good fight. The military forces have dramatically reduced drug use by 67%.
In order for civilian law enforcement to get military support, they would have to show what's called a drug nexus. At Waco, the ATF manufactured a drug nexus that wasn't there. They claimed that Branch Davidians had a meth lab. All those helicopters were part of the military support.
It's day 33 of that cult standoff with federal authorities near Waco.
Discussions about a surrender have slowed.
All day long, reinforcements were brought in from as far away as Fort Hood.
I think the ATF saw a political opportunity in the election of Bill Clinton, who ran on gun control, to expand its operation and expand its reputation.
A clip from Clinton's inauguration.
I was really torn by Waco. The FBI kept pushing for action, and they acted like this would be, you know, not too difficult to do. And I got it, but I mean, the truth that they were frustrated by being defied. Sometimes the right strategy is to wait. And I told them the story of what we did with the covenant and the sword of the arm of the Lord in Arkansas.
Janet Reno, Attorney General.
But they countered, and this is what really mattered to Janet Reno.
Attorney General.
But they countered, and this is what really mattered to Janet Reno, with the prospect that Koresh and his inner circle were abusing women and children. Finally, I told them they should go look at the record of what we did, but I would leave the decision up to them, and if they decided to do it, I would support them.
In Waco, Texas, the FBI has moved to a new and more active stage. An armored vehicle began punching holes. They have been filling the compound with tear gas.
Flames rise from part of the compound.
A little bit after noon, they ended up setting fire to the entire compound.
Black smoke rises from the building.
Here's another angle. You can see the black smoke from behind us. This is horrible.
And I was told by headquarters I had to go back and do a final press conference. I said, what am I supposed to say? There's nobody left.
I have been asked to read a statement from the director of the FBI.
I was trying to comfort people, but to see it all collapse was just overwhelming.
Text appears over the burning compound. Over 80 people died at Waco, including 25 children.
McVeigh is standing in the parlor of this old farmhouse that James Nichols owns, watching this live image of Waco burning, and tears are running down his eyes. And he's also thinking about his experience in the U.S. Army.
It really bothered McVeigh that the same Bradley fighting vehicles that he had fought in the Persian War were being used against the people at Waco. That was the turning point for McVeigh. He said in that very moment, he decided he was going to commit an act of terrorism.
Flames rage within the broken remains of the compound.
After the Ruby Ridge in Waco, we had this mass mobilization of militias.
A man addresses a group in military fatigues. Men fire weapons.
This thing just really explodes.
Gunfire flashes over footage of a road at night.
The critical issue is guns.
Someone examines a gun at a gun show.
He became obsessed with the idea the Democratic Party and Bill Clinton were scheming to take away Americans' right to guns.
McVeigh told a lot of people that he was just furious at me. He really hated the assault weapons ban.
It was the assault weapons ban, just as much as Waco and Ruby Ridge, that motivated McVeigh to bomb the Murrah Building.
We will finally ban these assault weapons from our street that have no purpose other than to kill.
McVeigh's gray sedan drives on a long road through flatland. Sunlight shines over distant mountains.
McVeigh charged from one end of the country to the other. Finally decided to build the bomb after months of buying 50-pound bags of ammonium nitrate at weed and seed stores across the Midwest, buying racing car fuel down in Texas.
A car speeds down a racetrack.
He ping-ponged back and forth from Kingman, Arizona, to Decker, Michigan, to Buffalo, New York.
Text appears, Niagara Falls. In a photo, McVeigh stands with Terry Nichols and a child near the falls.
McVeigh told us Nichols and Fortier helped me. Said I was the driving force behind all this. It was my plan, it was my crime. He came up with an action plan.
Moving trucks sit by a brick building. A sign reads Geary State Lake, Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks.
In Kansas, at the lake, the day before the bombing, with some coercion to get Terry Nichols there, and they build the bomb.
McVeigh said Nichols got cold feet, and McVeigh threatened him. That's why he went along with it.
The view looks outward from the driver's seat of a car, April 19th, 1995.
April 19th, and he gets back on the interstate, traveling alone.
A security camera still displays a moving truck outside a building entrance.
The enemy has many, many resources and assets at their disposal. The best one we have here is you.
The scene goes abruptly to black. Aerial news footage shows the Murrah Building after the explosion. Ruined offices filled with rubble stand open to the outside under a partly collapsed roof. Black smoke billows.
McVeigh told us that it was like the Death Star in Star Wars. He said there were all kinds of people in that Death Star who were just like secretaries and weren't leaders. They were killed too, but people all applauded when the Death Star blew up. He said, yes, innocent people had to die, but that's the way it goes.
He calls them collateral damage.
Scenes flash. Smoke obscures the destroyed building. An officer eyes McVeigh's getaway car. Agents and officers escort McVeigh in handcuffs. They put him in a helicopter. The helicopter flies through a pale sky. An older, white-haired, bespectacled white man in a brown suit sits for an interview. Stephen Jones, attorney for Timothy McVeigh.
I walked over and introduced myself. I said, Mr. McVeigh, I've been appointed to represent you, and I think I said I'm from Enid, Oklahoma. He shook my hand and said, I heard you were coming. He explained very candidly why he did what he was accused of. He exhibited some pride in that he had managed to carry it off.
Photos of Jones and McVeigh.
He wanted a defense based on necessity. Said, I had to do it because they were going to kill other American citizens. They had to be taught a lesson. And I said, well, Tim, tell me why it was necessary to kill children under the age of 6. He said, well, there were children at Waco. And I said, well, that may be true, but that's not an explanation of the necessity. What that is revenge. After that wouldn't go anywhere. What I was trying to do was to raise a reasonable doubt. We could argue to the jury, the government hasn't proven it.
I'm hopeful that no one will embarrass the state of Oklahoma by doing anything to any party in this case, which would turn this into a three-ring circus.
It couldn't be seen as a show trial. It had to be seen as lawyers vigorously representing him. My opposite number was Merrick Garland.
Merrick Garland.
He's been detained without bond.
It's important to recognize how Merrick Garland structured the criminal investigation and trial of McVeigh.
He testified that the cause of the explosion at the Murrah building was a bomb that was placed inside a Ryder truck.
He had a prosecutor's view in the sense that he wanted to keep the trial narrow and focused and limited to what was needed to make the case against first McVeigh and then Nichols.
Can you give us any estimate of how many people you still expect to bring additional charges against in this case?
No, I'm sorry. I really have to limit myself to what happened in the hearing today. And
Merrick always kind of kept his finger on the pulse of the case. You know, I'm not religious, but I did feel during that period of time like, oh, this is why I'm here. I mean, I really felt like I was doing something that mattered and that was worth doing.
Ayton Goldman, former assistant U.S. attorney.
On April 19, 1995, the bomb went off. I was in the office.
Beth Wilkinson, former assistant U.S. attorney.
DOJ wanted to show that the country could give a fair trial and due process to these individuals. This was right after the O.J. Simpson case, where there was such fanfare and media attention. Merrick wanted this to be all about the crime that had occurred and holding the individuals accountable.
In an indictment, a red mark highlights the text, with others unknown.
In the original indictment itself, it did say Tim McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and others unknown.
Why am I so confident that we got...
Why are you so confident?
The thoroughness of the investigation. FBI interviewed so many people that we could find. If you wanted to, you know, find somebody who said that, you know, Madonna did the bombing, you could find someone like that. Both Nichols and McVeigh had big defense teams at taxpayer expense. And I think their strategies differed. Stephen Jones had this whole public relations strategy where he, you know, traveled around the world to try to find these others unknown.
To say that there were others unknown was true. We were accused of being conspiracy theorists, but of course it was the government that alleged there was a conspiracy. We were just simply arguing over how large was the conspiracy and who was there.
In a photo, McVeigh smiles with Jones.
Tim wanted to be seen as this was the perfect mission. The building was destroyed. People were killed. There will be a revolution. I have set the revolution in motion. Me. No one else. Me. Me, myself, and I. It took probably about 7 or 8 days for me to start realizing that he was lying repeatedly. Probably the first one, I said, Tim, you've told me that no one else is involved. So why is the government talking to Michael and Lori Fortier? What do they know that we don't know? He didn't want to reveal who others were. He didn't want to solve the mystery.
People look through densely packed filing cabinets. Kathy Sanders.
It was actually my husband, Glenn, who started asking questions.
What's consumed our life? Our life took a 180-degree turn that day, and it probably will never be the same again.
After the bombing, I was so broken. For the first few weeks, I probably sat in the chair and cried. But when I got out of the chair, We had a dinner at our home for the families that had lost their children. The saddest of times, you get 19 families that lost their children. One of the young mothers said that when she dropped her boy off that morning, that she had seen the bomb squad downtown. And we're going, well, how do you know it was the bomb squad? Finally, very indignantly, she said they had big blue letters. Then we found a newspaper article from the Panola Watchman. It was an interview about this whole office full of people. They had been watching the bomb squad in the alleyway. The next day, my husband Glenn goes to the fire station. The fire chief said, oh no, sir, we had no idea. As my husband's leaving, the dispatcher there, he says, I'm not gonna lie for anybody. He said, we got a memo in this office last week to be on high terrorist alert.
The fire department received a call from the FBI 5 days before the bombing, warning that there were some people coming through town they should be on the lookout for.
When the fire chief is confronted with this information, he said, you know what, I made a mistake. It was our bomb squad truck down there.
The ATF director told reporters they had taken some precaution for the second anniversary of the siege in Waco.
I was very concerned about that. We did some things here in headquarters and in all of our field offices throughout the country to try to be more observant. But it was primarily, we didn't anticipate something like this. We were thinking about, demonstrations and things like that.
I think, yeah, we should have known that there was some danger in the building that day due to the fact that April 19th, is such a special day to the right wing.
So you're not somebody that could be characterized as a conspiracy theory person in the sense that you feel the federal government was in some way part of this explosion?
No, not at all. Glenn and I had so many questions after the bombing. They started the biggest manhunt in American history for John Doe number 2. And then they called it off.
Composite sketches of suspects.
The government originally described 2 men. They had the sketches of them. And there were numerous credible people in downtown Oklahoma City just before the bombing that claimed that they saw McVeigh and someone else. The government then, about 30 days later, said there isn't any John Doe 2. It was a mistake.
One sketch gets erased.
We had learned enough by then that we knew there was something wrong. 22 eyewitnesses told the FBI that they saw McVeigh downtown the morning of the bombing, and they all saw him with someone else. This is Michael Morose's testimony about McVeigh pulling up at Johnny's Tire Shop.
It was definitely a second person, no matter what.
He had dark hair. Maybe a dark complexion. He wasn't fair skin. I'm fair skin. I can tell the difference between fair and dark skin.
They brought him in. He picks McVeigh out of the lineup, and he tells him there was the man in the ball cap in the passenger side of the truck. I did get a lot of flack from the families and survivors when I wanted to find out about the others involved.
Sharon Coyne.
To try and point the blame at somebody else besides the people who parked the truck out front is irresponsible.
There are unanswered questions that we want answers to. I know that Melissa and Sharon have expressed views that they think all the truth will come out in the trial.
What do you think the truth is in all of this? Do you support your parents that there are many other people involved?
Definitely. I believe what they're doing is the right thing, and they're going to find the truth. And when they find out the truth, and everybody knows what's been going on, then we can put this all behind us.
Denver, Colorado.
A federal judge has moved the Oklahoma bombing trial to Denver, saying the defendants can't get a fair trial in Oklahoma. The judge said that outweighs the wishes of the victims' families who wanted the trial in Oklahoma, making it easier for them to attend.
Marcia Kimball.
With what happened April 19th, 1995, I don't want anybody to ever forget.
In the beginning, I started drinking. And one night, walking back to the bedroom, I passed out and cracked my head open. And I thought at that time, I better find something positive to do or I'm going to kill myself. So I started a group called Families and Survivors United. the pre-trial hearings started. Judge Mitch said, okay, you can be in this courtroom, but if you want to give an impact statement, you better leave because you can't do both. I said, wait a minute. I have a right to be in that courtroom.
She gives a statement on C-SPAN.
On April the 19th, 1995, the bomb that shattered the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City also shattered my life.
The victims' lobby in the Oklahoma City bombing was so powerful that they actually got a law passed.
It was a miracle. Like, it went through the House and Senate and was signed by Clinton in 2 days.
A group of people approaches a courthouse.
Prosecutors in the Oklahoma City bombing case have a valuable new witness, Michael Fortier.
At first, Michael Fortier refuses to cooperate, but he's got a wife that's pregnant. He makes a deal that he will fully cooperate as long as Laurie doesn't go to prison.
Courtroom sketches of Michael Fortier and McVeigh.
Fortier said McVeigh told me he wanted to bomb the building on the anniversary of Waco, April 19th, and that the bombing would trigger a second American Revolution.
McVeigh confided everything in him and to Laurie.
The most memorable moment in the trial to me was when Laurie Fortier talked about Timothy McVeigh getting Campbell's soup cans out of the kitchen cabinet and laying out how he was going to arrange the barrels of explosives in the truck. It was so real. It was so vivid. It was the kind of thing you couldn't make up if you wanted to.
I sat with Michael Fortier for hundreds of hours. I know everybody who was called on the spotlight phone card. When you ask me why I'm so confident that we got the right guys and that there's no one else kind of out there, it's because of things like Fortier and the phone card.
This was the government's version of the case, that the spotlight calling card is the sum and substance of McVeigh and Nichols' contacts, and it doesn't disclose any co-conspirators.
Redacted text marks a form.
I've seen 302s. 302s, a report by the FBI. Private citizens said the morning of the bombing, they saw somebody else in that truck with McVeigh. That's very troubling to me. And I will tell you why I think that never got followed up. Had they introduced that and followed that line of investigation, that would have diminished his culpability. The defense didn't bring it up because it's one more witness that says McVeigh was there.
We didn't call any of the eyewitnesses because their testimony would have been damaging to McVeigh. To call them, we're establishing that McVeigh was in downtown Oklahoma City when the government's case was largely circumstantial that he was there.
The sister of Oklahoma City bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh says she's sorry she has to cooperate with prosecutors in the case against her brother.
I think he's been unfairly demonized. He's just a normal person. He's not this evil thing they're painting him to be.
She says FBI agents frightened her into cooperating by threatening her with prosecution.
I was responsible for trying to prepare Jennifer McVeigh as a witness. Jennifer McVeigh's testimony, I think, was dramatic from beginning to end because of who she was. She said when she heard about the bombing, she immediately had this eerie feeling that she knew that her brother might have been involved.
Stephen Jones addresses reporters in front of the courthouse.
We did our best. We put all of our energy and effort into it, and we'll wait and see what the jury says.
Giving the court case number for the United States versus Timothy James McVeigh. Guilty. Guilty on all 11 counts.
It's as though Tim wanted us to fail. He wanted to say I did it. But first he wanted the jury trial just in case he got off. But then when he didn't get off, then he wanted the fame or infamy that he did it. I went to Tim, and I said, Tim, I need to tell you that I'm not the lawyer you need for the appeal. I'm going to seek to withdraw. I told him that I had figured out where he had lied and the proof that he had lied. And when I finished, He said, how would the truth help me? And I mistakenly said, I don't know that it would.
American flags wave outside a building.
I think people forget that a prosecution is not there to lay out a historical record of the entire movement or in everything that McVeigh ever did in his life. That's what the history books are for, and that's a different goal. Here, it was to prove the elements of the crime and hold him accountable.
The criminal law can only do so much. And we got everybody who was legally, criminally responsible for the bombing. There could have been other people who were, if we had the evidence, could have been criminally culpable. But then there's a whole universe of people who were not criminally culpable, but who bear some measure of moral responsibility.
Tim McVeigh was part of the group that wanted to declare war on America. The government thought, we tried to round them all up once with this sedition trial in 88, and we blew it. We can't do that again. We have to limit this. And the American people are none the wiser about how ugly and how serious some Americans are about destroying this nation.
Men in camo fire weapons from prone positions.
We always believed that there had to be more people involved. We started talking to militia groups, people who may have supported them. These extreme beliefs just weren't held by a few people. Actually, there are a lot of people out there who felt the way McVeigh did. So we would go to places like Elohim City in far eastern Oklahoma, where we believed that McVeigh had passed through.
People stand in a group and raise their hands.
They were following Christian identity. Their belief was anything that wasn't white was subhuman. If you just want to boil down to it, that's what it was.
A man stands before a long, low, domed building.
Elohim City is key to a lot of things here. I think McVeigh definitely was at Elohim City. ATF had an informant that put him there, Carolyn Howe.
NBC News has learned that the community was penetrated by this woman, Carol Howe, a paid government informant who was gathering information on possible threats against the U.S. government.
The government acknowledges in federal documents that she was their informant.
Carol Howe was an Oklahoma aristocrat. Her father was the CEO of a Fortune 500 company in Tulsa. But when she was just into her 20s, she got caught up with some really crazy right-wing folks. At the same time, she became an informant for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
We started following the trail of neo-Nazis, and she had a neo-Nazi boyfriend, a guy named Dennis Mahon.
The faster this country falls down, the faster we'll be able to rebuild a nation for ourselves.
Remarkably, Howe and Mahon appeared together in a 1994 German television interview. Howe gave the government information before the bombing on alleged threats by others in Elohim City, including this man, Andre Strassmeier. According to federal documents, Strassmeier was the military training officer for Mahon's organization. Strassmeier was last seen in Germany.
This is one of Carol Howe's reports to her ATF handler. She's talking about Andreas Strassmeier at Elohim City. Andy leads the young adults in guerrilla warfare and tactical maneuvers. His plans, quote, are to forcibly act to destroy the U.S. government with direct actions and operations. Assassinations, bombings, mass shootings, etc. He believes we cannot outbreed the enemy, so we must use mass genocide against them. And of course, the biggest enemy, the U.S. government.
Clark Brewster, attorney for Carol Howe.
She reported that there was an increasing discussion of violence, and there was a discussion about blowing up a building, even to the point that they made a visit to Oklahoma City and drove around. There wouldn't have probably been an Oklahoma City bombing, in my view, had Elohim City been investigated more diligently.
Carol Howe knew what was happening, and she told them. She had seen a guy. They identified him as Tim Tuttle. At the time, she wouldn't have known anything about who this guy was. But after the bombing, she knew it was Tim McVeigh. She had seen his pictures. Tim was walking through the camp with Andreas Strassmeier. Just some guy named Tim Tuttle walking with Andy the German.
Richard Reyna.
Andy Strassmeyer was an important person that I thought needed to be interviewed. I was able to meet with Strassmeyer, and I asked a simple question. I said, why is it that there are 302s, FBI 302s, interviews with all of these different radical people, but they don't have you? As I expected, you know, he knew nothing. He might have met Tim at a gun show. Couldn't remember.
Guns lie beside a Nazi flag.
I forgot about this person when I walked out of the show in Tulsa, you know, because it was just one of many people I met there. But it's possible that he remembered me and that he had a card from our church.
One of the things that really concerned me was when I got a hold of McVeigh's phone records. He called Elohim City 2 minutes after calling the Ryder Truck Company, and he asked to speak to Andreas Strassmeyer.
I heard he made a lot of phone calls, you know, and was telling people that something's going to happen.
The FBI interviewed thousands of people regarding Timothy McVeigh, including his second grade school teacher. But they didn't think it was important to talk to Andreas Strassmeyer. He wound up leaving the country and went back to Germany. It was like more than a year later that the FBI called and did a telephone interview with him.
Strassmeyer, there's controversy about him. Some people think he's a source of the Israelis, and some people think he's a source of the West German government. At the time, the German government was very unhappy with the FBI because we have guidelines on how we investigate domestic terrorism. They're pretty limiting. And so they wanted to try to get their own information. Somebody should have looked at it.
I personally was responsible for searching the intelligence files here in the United States, and there's no evidence there was foreign involvement. McVeigh had met him at a gun show and called him, you know, 2 weeks before he engaged in the bombing. That doesn't show there's any connection. He met lots of people at gun shows.
There was certainly evidence that Tim McVeigh had probably been at Elohim City. He kept denying that he had been there, but yet he was stopped, I believe, by an Arkansas highway patrolman on a road that led to Elohim City. There were people that said he had been there.
I told him, I said, Tim, you know and I know that you were used. He didn't say anything. He didn't say no, it didn't happen. The way that group was always together, there's just no way he was not there.
Armed people in camo walked down a slope.
Strassmeyer was there. Ellison was there. Snell was buried there in Elohim City.
On the day Snell was executed, he asked for the TV to be turned on in his cell, and the prison watch log notes that inmate Snell smiled and chuckled as he watched the coverage of the Oklahoma City bombing. It's just hard for me to believe that it was all coincidence.
It's not a coincidence. Remember, the idea of blowing up the Murrah building was hatched 10 years earlier among members of the Covenant Sword and Arm of the Lord. This was a plan that not just McVeigh, but the others who were at Elohim City decided to resurrect from the ashes.
I came to understand Elohim City was the training ground. Covenant Sword in the Arm of the Lord had moved its operations to the Cookson Hills of Oklahoma, and that's where they were going to train these people to overthrow the government. These guys were ready for war.
A masked white man gives a Nazi salute. Denver, Colorado, June 13, 1997.
In court, McVeigh watched intently as the jury filed in. Judge Richard Mach asked for their decision. The jury recommends the following, said the judge, that Timothy James McVeigh be sentenced to death.
I went to the bomb site every day after the bombing, asking myself, what could I do to feel better? And I finally came to the conclusion that the day that we would take Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols from their cage to kill him was simply not going to be part of my healing process.
Glenn and Kathy Wilburn.
My husband was dying during McVeigh's trial. The babies are dead, and then Glenn died. The trials came and went. There's a lot of unanswered questions. I believe I owed it to them to continue that journey to try to get answers to these questions. Over the years, it's been a balancing act, almost like a tightrope act for me to not get lumped in with the crazies. I needed to just find my truth, not invent it. I learned about these groups around the country. They thrive on hate, and I think it's like a cancer. I went to the Aryan Nation compound in Hayden Lake, Idaho. I had heard that Timothy McVeigh had been through there, and that's how they helped shape his hateful ideals.
A sign reads, "Whites Only."
And I said, "I'm here to see Pastor Richard Butler. For me, he's the head of the snake. But I've got a desperation to know the truth, and I'm willing to dance with the devil to get it."
We're talking about creating a national state for the white Aryan.
Begins his sermon, and he looks at me and he says, "One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, and that Timothy McVeigh was a great man and a martyr for the cause." And he actually teared up when he said, "I am so sorry about your little Aryan grandsons." He said, "I cried when I saw them on TV."
Katie Couric interviews Bud and Kathy.
Since the tragedy here in Oklahoma City, some of those who lost loved ones have found a new purpose in life. Bud Welch, Kathy Wilburn, good morning. So nice to see you both.
Good morning, Katie.
I know that both of you called Bill McVeigh, Timothy McVeigh's father, the forgotten victim.
You know, if I put myself in his shoes and I wonder how it must feel to, you know, to wait to have your child executed, it's got to be terrifying.
We have to recognize what an execution is. An execution is an event. It's staged. We know what time the killing's going to happen. It's nothing more than a staged political event. It does nothing more or less for society than that.
Tim McVeigh's father was on the news. I could see this man, a broken man, with grief in his eyes. And my thought was, I want to go tell that man that I care how he feels, and I don't blame him for what his son had done.
A photo of Jennifer and McVeigh.
When Bill opened the door and he introduced me to Jennifer, and there's a picture kind of behind me of Tim. I looked at Bill out of the corner of my eye, and I could see at that moment a love that this father had for this son. And Jennifer just kind of went to sobbing. I held her face in my hands, and I said, "Honey, I'll do everything I can to keep your brother from being killed." All of a sudden, it felt like this tremendous weight had been removed from my shoulders, and I never felt closer to God than I did at that moment. Because what I recognized that Saturday morning was the day that our parents die, we go to the hilltop and we bury them. The day our children die, we bury them in our heart, and it never goes away.
Sunlight shines on large office buildings. Men escort Terry Nichols up a ramp outside.
Terry Nichols entered the courthouse on the first day of his trial. He will face a crowd of people. 12 of those could ultimately decide if he dies.
If I had the opportunity to sit down with Terry Nichols, I would press on who else was involved. Where did the money come from?
Aryan Republic Army, ARA recruitment video. A masked man pours money into another masked man's lap.
I see you boys had a good mission yesterday.
Did the funding for the Oklahoma City bombing come from those bank robberies that were done by radical groups?
The accused Midwestern bank bandits are white supremacists who allegedly robbed 22 banks in 7 states. The take, $250,000. Law enforcement officials believe the money was distributed to other white supremacist groups. Members of the gang were frequent visitors to LOM City.
Cash lies on a table. Men escort McVeigh.
Tim had no visible means of support. You got to feed yourself. You got to keep the car going. You got to have money for just to be able to spend the night someplace. He was always renting a room. Where'd the money come from? And then when I read his sister said that he told her in his letter that he got some money out of robbing banks. And there were other robberies. He also robbed a gun dealer named Roger Moore.
About 6 months before the Oklahoma City bombing, a masked gunman allegedly robbed gun dealer Roger Moore of gold bullion, coins, and weapons.
McVeigh met this fellow, Roger Moore, at one of the gun shows, and they become something of business partners. He and Roger Moore ultimately had a falling out, and McVeigh is the mastermind behind a robbery at Roger Moore's house, and Terry Nichols committed the robbery.
Roger Moore was called as a witness because Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh stole weapons from him, and they were used in part to fund the bombing.
Courtroom sketches from Terry Nichols' trial.
At Terry Nichols' trial, he was not like Timothy McVeigh at all. He didn't make eye contact with anyone. He was always looking down. When the judge had a recess, I saw this little lady standing out in the hall. I realized it was Terry Nichols' mother. I walked up to her. I said, "I'm Kathy Wilburn," and she begins to cry. She said, "I know who you are. I've seen you on TV." And I put my arms around her and I said, "Well, I want you to know how sorry I am for your family." And then we went back in the courtroom and I just sat down with her. It was like Terry Nichols, the bomber, became my friend Joyce's son. The jury thought he was guilty, but they didn't know how guilty. They had questions just like I did.
The jury found Nichols guilty of only conspiracy and involuntary manslaughter. Nichols won't get the death penalty for his federal conspiracy conviction.
Jury forewoman.
There are other people out there, and decisions were probably made very early on that Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols were who they were looking for, and the same sort of resources were not used to try to find out who else might be involved.
A few days after the trial, I had a letter. Return address was Terry Nichols. And I thought, I'm not looking for a pen pal. And if I was, it wouldn't be the Oklahoma City bomber. And then it kind of like dawned on me. Well, who's going to know more about the bombing than the bomber himself? We started writing back and forth.
The Terry Nichols relationship, I still don't really understand it. I frequently tell my mom, and when we do presentations around the United States, that, you know, if I ever saw Terry Nichols and we were in a room together for 5 minutes, I'd be the only one that comes out.
I have forgiven, yes. Do I think people should be punished? Yes. Forgiveness and punishment are two different things. I want everybody involved in this to be accountable. You know, forgiveness is a choice you make. You can forgive, or you can stay bitter. And forgiving Terry Nichols was one of the best choices I ever made. It changed my life. Terry Nichols was remorseful, unlike McVeigh. And he told me, "Whenever I'm not under the threat of the death penalty anymore, I'm going to tell you everything." And he has tried.
Kathy sits at a laptop.
I'd like to read you part of this letter that Terry Nichols sent me. "So to put everything in a nutshell, Kathy, Timothy McVeigh was the manipulated foot soldier. Roger Moore, the middleman who supplied Tim with encouragement, instructions, and some explosives. And the top dog, the director who orchestrated it all, is a rogue FBI agent with the help of others, who I will not name at this time. I don't know if what he wrote was true or not, but after that letter, he was notified by the warden that I was to be taken off his calling list. We've been stopped."
Text appears over footage of a prison, Terre Haute, Indiana, June 2001.
Here's how it works. Timothy McVeigh lives in a special confinement unit, that is the building there with the green roof. He will be transported by van to the execution house.
An American flag waves outside the prison.
"He told us that when the federal government puts me to death, I'm still going to be the winner because it's 168 for Tim McVeigh and one for the government."
An IV bag of clear liquid hangs beside an execution table.
You have these three tubes that are coming out of a wall with the three chemicals, poison, to kill him. The executioner was given the order, and all of a sudden these tubes started swaying in like this ghostly way. And meanwhile, McVeigh is looking straight up at a camera that is giving a live feed to an auditorium where other victims and family members, survivors, are watching.
He glares this go to hell look at us. They pushed the button, and he went, he was gone.
A photo of McVeigh in orange pants and a sweatshirt.
He died with his eyes open.
A photo of a younger McVeigh replaces it.
I wonder what would happen if I'd known Timothy McVeigh when he was a boy. I wonder if I would have gone out of my way to befriend him. I wonder if, you know, I wonder about all that. McVeigh was a tragic example of a guy who thought our differences were more important than what we have in common. Were there objective reasons that he felt the way he did, both personal and psychological? Absolutely. And political and economic? Yes. But we can't blow the house up. It doesn't matter whether he was right about anything or not. What matters is he decided he should kill people he didn't know, including little kids. But the words he used, the arguments he made, literally sound like the mainstream today. Like he won.
Text appears, third wave. A dark memorial stands at the edge of a reflecting pool. Text appears, Oklahoma City National Memorial, April 19th, 2022. A crowd gathers near the memorial under a partly cloudy sky.
Tim McVeigh set out to destroy the government. He destroyed my family. Well, my brothers passed away in the Oklahoma City bombing, and we go there to remember.
The risk of terrorism, it's always kind of in the back of your head.
I think there will be civil war in our country. It's frightening that there are lessons to be learned from what happened here in Oklahoma City.
The reason we come back here every year is that this wasn't a one-off thing. It can really happen again.
Where we're standing now was the Alfred P. Murrah Building. The empty chairs represent the 168 victims. The gate behind me says 901, the moment of innocence before the bombing. The gate over your shoulder says 903, the aftermath. Today.
This year we're living in is not much different from 1995. People yelling at each other, not making arguments based on fact but emotion.
Many folks feel left behind, like their American dream has been stolen.
No sail! No sail! No sail! No sail! No sail! No
that rage doesn't disappear. It can explode on the fringes as we've seen too many times since April 19, 1995.
Footage of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally.
The Oklahoma City bombing was a crossroads. It was a huge signpost in history. America, wake up. But I think that sign got blown down.
In a mass shooting, 180-page manifesto.
He didn't come to worship. He came to kill.
Tree of Life Synagogue has never been the same.
Every time I hear a news report on mass shootings and domestic terrorism, right-wing extremism, it always reminds me of when I was in the movement, how dangerously close we as a group got, how dangerously close I got to committing domestic terrorism.
A photo of armed men at the January 6th insurrection.
So much has changed from our days back in the 80s. How mainstream extremism has become. That was something we hoped for. I'm seeing that now, and honestly, it scares me. Closest thing that has happened since Oklahoma City, of course, is the January 6th riot on the Capitol building.
Footage of a pro-Trump crowd outside the Capitol building.
On January 6th, I was the emergency planning specialist along with the incident commander and everybody else who showed up. So I was at that scene for about 18 hours.
People stormed the building.
When I saw the storming of the Capitol on January 6th, I'm thinking, what's the chances that my boy's going to be down at the bombing and going to be involved in this as well? And I was concerned for his safety.
There was no call for what they did on January 6th. What they did was wrong, and they should be prosecuted for it. Every single day, we have protests. The majority of the people up there are peaceful. But I believe as long as our country continues to divide itself, I believe there's more to come. You poke a dog long enough, the dog's going to bite. If you're going to push people to the extremes, violence is inevitable.
Daniel and Kathy walk through the gate at the Oklahoma City National Memorial.
And I drove up to this building 100 times. We used to go on our break up there over that wall.
Mm-hmm.
We would stay, we'd take treats and stuff and go up there and watch the kids play in the playground.
That's where I found Colton, you know that, right?
Yeah.
Right there.
Flowers adorned high-back chairs sitting in rows in a field.
When I delved into the bombing and started having questions, I told a reporter, I said, you know, it's not going to be too many years that when I tell someone I lost my grandchildren in the bombing, they'll say, which one?
Exactly.
And that's where we are today.
They stand facing one of the chairs. Kathy brushes hair back from her face.
It's still hard to believe it's been 28 years.
Yeah. Love you guys. We'll see you next year. You ready?
Yeah. Bye, guys.
Kathy holds Daniel's arm. He waves to the chair. They leave. As they move through the gate, the view moves upward to the text 903 above. The scene fades to black. Text appears. The Oklahoma City bombing remains the deadliest act of domestic terrorism against the government in U.S. history. Audio description provided by International Digital Center, written by Dakota Green, voiced by Michael Tricario. Credits, directed by Mark Levin, produced by Daphne Pinkerson, Mark Levin, executive producer Katie Couric, producer Maria McIntyre, edited by Michael J. Palmer, coordinating producer Elizabeth Sering, MAEA, creative producer Anthony Padone, director of photography Jordan Fisher, associate producers Daniel Levesque, Ariel Ackerley, Robert Brooks, co-editors Henry Moskowitz, John Maidman, James Lester, original music by Wendy Blackstone, for HBO, executive producers Nancy Abraham, Lisa Heller, Sarah Rodriguez. Copyright 2024 Home Box Office, Inc. All rights reserved. Logos, Barolo Films. Blowback Productions. HBO, a presentation of Home Box Office.